All right, this is Neil Rockhind, and I am honored to be joined by one of the top trial lawyers in the country, John Phillips. John, thank you for joining me here on the Killer Cross-Examination podcast.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So you've had a storied career. Tell me, first of all, if you would, about your career, how you got to this point, and talk about what kind of law you practice.
Okay. So my grandfather and great-grandfather were lawyers in Mississippi, and I never met either one of them. They both unfortunately predeceased me, but I heard these Atticus Finch caliber stories from my mom about, you know, her dad and granddad, and something about that stuck. And so I went to Alabama. You know, you come out of law school and you're not really sure what you, some people know exactly what they're going to do, or they're going to get that top tier, you know, six figure job. And I was just kind of a bit of a lost puppy and went back home to Mobile, Alabama, and clerked for a judge, trial court judge. And, you know, as the law clerk in a relatively small town, especially 20 years ago, you got all of the access. I mean, it's judicial backstage pass like nothing else. And so, you know, you're getting the juror's water, and you're kind of accidentally on purpose hearing things and seeing how they think, and being in the, you know, the first room before they get to the courtroom with the mass selection process, and just seeing, you know, seeing that backstage pass of justice, you know, made me want to be a trial lawyer. And then I got the proverbial offer I couldn't refuse, because there weren't that many offers, do an insurance defense, right? And I didn't know what insurance defense was. You know, I guess it's self-explanatory. You're defending based on insurance. And so off I went for about 9 years with State Farm and Coca-Cola and Hertz and Enterprise and Progressive and, you know, all these big companies paying me to learn how to take a doctor's deposition. You know, when you're hourly and learning, it's a lot better than when you're contingency and trying to figure it out. After that, I had a year and a half stint at Morgan & Morgan, where I went from insurance defense to, you know, the crosshairs of mass personal injury plaintiff's work, and couldn't cut that model, you know, working on 500 cases at any given point. Started my own firm, and off we've gone for the last, you know, 9 years, 10 years.
You're one of the few lawyers I know that has given a TED Talk. I've given a TED Talk. I did a TED Talk on the subject of, it was called Joy of the Jury. It really was about the impact of people that want to get rid of and don't want to take part in a jury notice. They a jury summons. It comes to them, and they figure out every excuse in the book. But we need some of those folks to be on juries, and how they can make a difference in someone's life. And you gave a TED Talk that I watched. Tell me about your TED Talk, and tell me what the subject was, and what the aftermath of you, the case you talked about, and the aftermath of that TED Talk.
Okay. So, you know, I kind of gave the history, and very early on in that history, a young man was shot and killed named Jordan Davis. And Jordan Davis was listening to loud music with his friends in Jacksonville, Florida. And this white man, Jordan's black, white man pulls up and says, turn that music down, turn that music down. And Jordan's friend turns down the music. And Jordan's like, nah, turn it back up. And so they turn it back up. Argument ensues. There's two documentaries about it, but one of them is appropriately entitled 3.5 minutes, 10 bullets. And that's exactly what happened. In the span of 3.5 minutes, the altercation over music results in 10 shots being fired, Jordan being killed. And through a mutual friend, me winding up in the living room of this family. And I tell that in the story in the TED Talk, and you know, still to this day, it rings my soul true that Jordan was killed November 23rd, 2012. My firstborn, Bennett, was born February 2nd, 2012. So, you know, 10 months, 9 months before. And I had lost my mother about 3 months before that. And so had I not known loss of a consequential nature and the love of that firstborn son, I never would have been ready for that case. On top of, you know, coming from South Alabama and just, you know, as I say in the TED Talk, you know, nobody's going to raise their hand and say, yeah, I'm biased. I'm racist. Yep, that's me. But you just, you grow up in your own bubble and you think everything's okay and fine because, you know, you're raised right-ish, you know. But you've got to peel away the onion, so to speak, and realize, you know, I talk about in the TED Talk how I'd walk by, you know, the plaque where Vivian Malone and, you know, other African-Americans fought so hard to get into Alabama. And I'd think, oh, that's nice. It's solved. We're all together. Not, you know, for a second contemplating, you know, the systemic issues and racism and bias and all that goes into, you know, American society to this day. And that TED Talk was kind of this cathartic, you know, soul bearing, expression of kind of my walk and you know, education, being the, you know, white guy who was taken by the hand by this black family and you know, exposed to the underbelly of justice, racism, you know, bias and just kind of how I came out the other side of it as a full-fledged, you know, civil rights lawyer.
How in the TED Talk you discuss the importance of the difference between walking a mile in someone else's shoes and actually getting into their skin and attempting to live like them. Tell me why that analogy stuck with you then, how it applied to the case involving that young man, and how you apply that going forward.
It's you know, it's a line from To Kill a Mockingbird. I mean, I grew up in Mobile in Monroeville, Alabama, where you know, that's Monroeville is the actual place that Maycomb, Alabama is in To Kill a Mockingbird. And so I saw, you know, being in a private school there, just how racially challenged it is, and you know, you almost become a bit more racist by peer pressure. And it, having, you know, a very compassionate, empathetic mother always kind of correcting me along the way as the baby bird, you know, kind of saved me from you know, what could be, you know, the reddest neck in the South, right? And so you do have that Atticus Finch line where he tells Scout, you know, sitting on the porch swing, you know, you've got to crawl in the skin and walk around a bit. And it's the superficial, you know, analogy of walking in the shoes. Certainly you could stand in somebody's shoes, but you're not doing very much, you know, that we all share the same, you know, footprint, right? But it's deeper in, you know, you have to recognize if you're going to do work that involves race, that look, that you'll never understand. Like I tell people, I mean, we've handled so many cases where where a person loses their child, and I say, listen, I'll never understand. I'll never be able to feel your pain, but I'm going to try, you know, and I'm going to listen. And it's the same, you know, same thing to some extent. And I hated, you know, I hated as a, you know, a white person, you know, kind of being told that I couldn't understand, or that, you know, I'm from such a position of privilege, you know, white privilege, but it's true. And so it was kind of walking in a skin is it requires some level of embracing that it's not even what's said in a country club versus
like empathy.
What's said
you really have to. You, one of the lines that you used was not just identifying, and it really struck with me. It really struck home. Not identifying how far somebody else has come, but identifying what they still don't have or what they've yet to achieve. And I thought that was I hadn't looked at it that way in such stark terms.
Right. I mean, you just got to open up, and it's that bubble, you know, you just got to pop your own bubble and hop in somebody else's bubble and really try to understand it from their perspective.
And you're in that TED Talk, which I'm going to use as a jumping off point into your practice. You engaged in some, I don't want to say theatrics because that's not the right word, but you used a visual image of a jacket that you were wearing. That when you tapped it, it made a noise. That was, I think, a Kevlar or a plated jacket. Tell me why you used that in that talk, and then I want to sort of talk about how, what you did to emphasize the point about how we can move forward, and then how do you use visual imagery like that in the courtroom?
Spoiler alert, right?
Yes.
So, you know, I give the TED Talk, and I'm already uncomfortable. Again, I'm introverted enough that, or extroverted enough that six people I'm cool with, you know, 400 plus live simulcast. Plus that was like my second real speech, you know, not again working on a case, but, and I was bearing my soul and talking about, you know, my family, that it was uncomfortable. But I was wearing probably my least comfortable sport coat, which has Kevlar plates in it. And I actually acquired that during Michael Dunn's criminal trial, the person that killed Jordan Davis, because there were threats saying, as I say in the talk, honey, I got to tell you about a threat I got today. They're saying that I might not make it through trial, or that, you know, lawyers like me, people like me need to have cash on hand in case your kid disappears. And so I never wore that to court, but we kept it in my car. And I have gone to other scenes and other investigations where I've literally wrapped it around my, you know, the back of my car seat. And so it's truly been used and, you know, but in the TED Talk, I don't reveal that it's Kevlar until the end. And then it's look, we've got to live in a society. We've got to produce a society where civil rights lawyers and the people they represent don't need Kevlar, right? Like why in the world are we in such a violent society that somebody trying to fight for equality is getting death threats? That's a significant problem, but it dates back to, you know, if my grandfather and great grandfather were the men they said they were, and I know for a fact, and I've actually independently researched it, and they were, you know, they're worried about the Klan and night raids, you know, and that TED Talk kind of goes through all of that. But the reveal is I throw the jacket off and say, why do we need to be defined by fear.
It has such, but it it created such a visual image that it stuck with me. And I don't know if that was something that you came up with on the moment, at this, on the fly, or if you thought about it. But in court, I assume, and I want you to tell me about that, that you use visual imagery and analogies and hypotheticals in order to layer your arguments. And if so, tell me how you do that, and then I want to get into some of the big cases you've handled and how you cross-examine. So walk me through how you do that in court.
You know, you're always looking for, because you've got generally in Florida 6, Georgia 12, but you've got strangers, and they learn differently, they process differently, and so, you know, our typical presentations are sometimes hybrid of speaking and PowerPoint, you know, but you're always looking for a prop, and you know that some of the theatrics of for instance the Johnny Depp trial, most judges wouldn't put up with. You know, you get the eye rolling. There's certain things, particularly in federal court, that you'll just flat be kicked out or called out in front of the jury, and good luck, you know, good luck once that happens. And so, you know, there's certain times when you can slip in a, you know, theatrical moment, but it's the small things, right? So there was one particular trial that I'll use as an example, where I knew my client was an emotional wreck. And, you know, you coach them not to cry and when to, you know, like try not to create such sympathy that you're going to have a mistrial. But I knew she was going to cry. And so, and the tissues stay on the courtroom box, like they're the witness box. And so during a break, I moved the tissues about 8 feet away. And you know, the waterworks started, and the bailiff, and it was a case where tears were okay, right? Some level of tears. And the bailiff, you know, realized this woman's crying, we're in the South, and he goes to her aid and brings her the tissues. Did I do anything wrong?
No.
But you created a moment where you've got this, you know, you've got this officer who is coming to her aid and adding emphasis without being, you know, better call Saul,
right,
about.
Where the lawyer does the, are you okay? Can you continue on? Which, I mean, if it seems natural, and it is natural, it can work. But, you know, there are times where, as you know, when you're questioning a client or a witness and you're questioning somebody and you bring up, like, are you okay? Can you continue? Do you? And the jury looks at you and they're like, I mean, okay, you've asked that like 10 times. It doesn't seem very sincere. So that was pretty clever.
I'm from Alabama and still live in, you know, Jacksonville's the pretty deep South as Florida goes. And, you know, whenever my client, particularly a woman client, you know, you got the jury coming in, I stand and I'll stand behind her and kind of hold her chair and, you know, in a another $1 million verdict we got, one of the potential jurors even said, I got to keep my eye on you because of the way you cared about your client, the way you kind of held her chair. And I said, ma'am, listen, if you're worried about that, you're going to see it a lot, because I was raised by a Southern mother who taught me to take care of people. And, you know, the other side didn't object, like, well, because she's critical of him. And I'm like, well, I won that juror over. She stayed. And so
that's such a wonderful point. And that is the way you are. So you weren't faking that. How important is that in the courtroom? You've gotten some huge verdicts. I think still to this day you have a $495 million verdict in a case I want you to talk about. I think that was Callie McCoy's case.
Khalil McCoy, yeah.
You've represented Omarosa Manigault, who everybody knows, and you can talk about that. I'm going to try to pronounce his real name as opposed to the name he's. It's Joseph Maldonado. Is it Passage or Passage? But he's known as Joe Exotic or the Tiger King. And then obviously you've been involved in the Abigail Disney case. The case is going to go on and on, and people can look at your website. There are, I mean, if you want to see numbers kind of in a success story, you can go to John Phillips' website and look up the verdicts. They're huge. But that doesn't come by accident.
It doesn't. And it's, you know, I didn't know who or what I was, you know, until I started getting my own voice. And look, there's lines we all steal from each other. And you know, I've got in my script that we keep, I don't really use it as often as I used to, but for cross-examination or closing or jury selection, that was handed down by a lawyer, which was handed down by a lawyer, which was handed down by another lawyer. And there's good bits in there, right? But like any stand-up comedian, if you're going up performing somebody else's bits, you're gonna eventually, it's gonna catch up to you. And so my bits are based on being an empath and you know, kind of riding emotional waves without getting emotional. And so it's, you know, the Southern gentleman with a little bit of a sense of humor, but rarely, because you can't be not taken seriously, you know, is kind of my voice. And it's been more interesting as I've done more TV stuff or documentaries or, you know, Lord forbid, season two of Tiger King, because now I go into the courtroom and the other side has to really decide whether they want to voir dire the work that I've done. You know, did you, it hasn't come up yet, but I suspect at some point,
it will.
Are you a Tiger King fan? Do you know Joe Exotic is, and is that going to be, you know, something that you're going to give Mr. Phillips credit or prejudice? I ain't bringing that stuff up. And so because then I look like I'm trying to be the famous lawyer, right, in the courtroom. And I love most of all being underestimated and just kind of, oh, shucks, ma'am, you know, don't worry. And then, you know, we get into opening and cross-examination and closing, and they're like, shit, this guy's a little bit more than I thought he was.
I find it hard to believe that people still underestimate you, but I guess it could happen. I mean, are there lawyers out there that still underestimate you despite your success? And you're obviously savvy. You're a incredibly well-known lawyer. You've gotten, you are clearly empathic, and you can relate to people, and you've gotten some great results. Are there lawyers who live under a rock to that degree that they just take you for granted, or they just think, well, I'm going to bowl over this guy?
Well, look, most of my stuff,
I'm not taking you for granted.
No, and I appreciate it. But most of my stuff is, you know, there's a lot of sensation in it. You know, the Omarosa versus Trump and the Tiger King stuff. And locally, I mean, I've already done an interview today for a local station, and I could do those, you know, daily on whatever the topic is. And I've slowed them down, but everybody just kind of underestimated me for the first few years as just kind of the media lawyer, you know. Sometimes they're not as friendly as that, you know, media prostitute.
Mm-hmm.
And cool, whatever, but I'm getting earned media. I am not paying for things that the advertising lawyers pay for, and I'm showing myself as the expert in the field. So it's been this amazing marketing thing, but because of it, you know, at least in our area, the advertising lawyers aren't the ones that go to the courtroom. And in here, you know, the earned media guys tend to know their way around. Not all of them, but it's this, John's just Joe Exotic's lawyer. It's hard to take Joe Exotic's lawyer seriously in some instances, right? And I get that. And I use that. But on the same token, we've only been on Joe Exotic's team for 14 months. And we have fully briefed out a motion for new trial. We have filed a separate appeal that wasn't filed prior. Everything's ready for an evidentiary hearing. Like, the legal work that got there, I have five. Like, I'm at my desk. Let's see if I still have them in here. I think they've gone to the safe. But I have, like, a stack of, like, seven cell phones that we've gotten witnesses to turn over to us and crawled them and found what we needed. That takes a lot to get somebody that's adverse to you to hand their cell phone over to you to then crawl. And that's where you kind of, to do this work, you know, and you can outsource it and have investigative teams and all that. But to do this work, you know, you've got to have some hustle. You've got to be able to be charismatic and, you know, not the, again, I love the Saul character, but it's a character. And I'm sure, you know, you and I have both met people that are pretty, might even be worse.
Yes.
But
I don't even think of Saul when you say the Saul character. I think of a couple of other guys that I know, and I think right. of that, that's who comes to mind for me.
But it's, you know, but in, you know, lawyers I tend not to hang out with, you know, lawyers on a regular basis because we're a very competitive and judgmental lot. Right.
Yes.
And so,
and we're, it's, you got to have an ego and you got to.
Yeah. And it's, yeah. Look, I've said it over and over again. I'm going to put it in the book one day. I like my Wikipedia page. I like my bio. I like what we're building here. I'm 47. I'm just kind of hitting my prime. But here's the thing. I've got a 10-year-old, a 7-year-old, and a 4-year-old. And if one of them don't steal the show at my funeral and say, y'all knew him as a great lawyer, but let me tell you, he was an even better dad than I've failed miserably. And so it's that balance.
No one's tombstone that ever says, I worked harder and longer at the expense of everything else in life. That's not a tombstone that anybody's ever ordered. No one that I know.
No one
that I know. Tell me a little bit about your, because you are a charismatic guy, and you come across as someone who sound sincere. And I'm not saying that you're not, but you have that sound to you, and you have that look to you. Tell me about your courtroom style. Is that your courtroom style, if you could define it, or is it different than that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the difference is the custom suit, right? You know, which as COVID has changed my weight a little bit, keeps, you know, I've got a trial next month, and I've got a goal that I got to lose 10 pounds before trial, just so my suits fit right. But
the suits in the part of the closet that we all have, we look at and say, dear old friends, I hope to get reacquainted with you one day.
I got them. I lost 44 pounds. I was pushing 270 about 3 years ago and bought a Peloton tread and a Peloton bike and said, I've got to fix this for my kids. Right. I'm you know, too many lawyers, especially PI lawyers. You know, if you really examine the commercials are heavy. You know, we have access to good foods and all that. And so, and stress and all that. And so, I lost 44 pounds and, you know, proudly got all my either ordered some new suits and got some of my old suits chopped up except for like two. And luckily I chopped them as I was losing. So there's some fat suits in there, but I have suits that I love and I could get them remade, but I just love them and they have success in them and I'm superstitious. And so I've got to put on, you know, I've got to put on the suit, and you know, great paralegals throughout my career that have my exhibits ready, and we finally got a stable of absolute amazing lawyers that are with me that you know, I'm slowly giving up. That the last time I'm retrying a case next month, that I got a $4 verdict the last time, and it broke my soul because police responding to a loud music complaint and shot through a closed garage door. How do you lose that case?
Tell me about that case, because I wanted to ask you about it. That was
So Greg Hill was in his garage listening to a mixtape, and it. You know, we talk about rap music and like even now it's making the news in Florida again because there's a new loud music law that people can get pulled over that starts July 1st. And, you know, Greg was in his garage listening to a mixtape of Drake, Rihanna, you know, stuff boring white people listen to. And it was right at the time school gets out. A lady that's not named Karen, but I will refer to her as Karen to protect her privacy and while insulting her, you know, literally called 911.
It's an inside joke because my wife's name is Karen.
Okay. Well, I'm sure she's a good Karen. And so, you know, she called 911 complaining of obscene music. Police responded very quickly and arrived on the scene, two police cars on the driveway, knocked on the garage door, knocked on the front door, came back around, and Greg snatched open his garage door, closed his garage door. One police officer jumped back, shot four times
through the closed garage door,
100%, no question, and killed him, and didn't know they killed him. So then they put tear gas in the windows and you know, SWAT showed up, this crazy scene. Meanwhile, he bled out, died, and we tried the case. 31 live witnesses, 6 days, 10 hours of deliberation, hung jury, forced to go back, came back out absolutely defeated, and it was a jury of eight because we had six and two alternates, and the alternates deliberated. And so they came back $1 for each child for pain and suffering and $1 for funeral expenses, and worst loss of my career. They just devastated. And we've since interviewed the jurors. And so, you know, the disputed fact in that case was a gun was found, you know, the officer said, neatly tucked in in Greg Hill's back pocket, unloaded, no DNA, no blood splatter, no fingerprints. Okay. Some might assume that's a throwdown planted gun, and we went there and I think they didn't like that. But either way, because these shots all landed within 1.4 seconds, and he was immediately incapacitated with the brain shot, he couldn't have put it back. The other issue is where the shots were by his right hip and stomach, abdomen, and there was no blood splatter on the gun. There's blood splatter on the garage door. And so how would a clean gun get back in his pocket? And so the juror said, listen, dummy, next time you try this case again, don't concede that the gun was out, because it wasn't. You conceded that as an alternative theory, and I couldn't fight for you anymore. You know, you started out 6-2 and then you went 2-6, and the two older white gentlemen said, there's no way we're giving them anything, and that's how we're here.
It's a maddening case, man. That story is maddening, and it's a maddening case.
So the good news is,
yeah, tell me the good news in that,
you know, we fought it. I did the appeal. If you like my TED talk, you'll love my oral argument at the 11th Circuit. But I did the appeal, myself, and I hated appellate law, but that one was so special. And they introduced probation. And so they played the scary black man defense, and it worked. But they got in that he was on probation. Cops didn't know he was on probation. They were there for loud music. And the case law and civil rights cases are pretty clear that probation never should have come in. And so ultimately, we won on like three different grounds. They also had a Rule 26 violation because they filed a motion the week before trial to bring the gun into the courtroom. The gun was never on a Rule 26. It was never disclosed. And so I'm like, there was a list with the gun on it of property, but I didn't know you had the gun because I would have tested the gun. And yeah, the court even said, yeah, the grocery list is not the groceries, counsel. And so it was, you never want to be on the bad side of a hot bench. And I never was. The other side was. But there was a point during my oral arguments, there was law students sitting in the gallery. And I even like addressed the law students because I was so far ahead that I was like, listen, when I went to law school, I had a constitutional law gun case assigned to me. And I said, no way am I going to be doing appellate constitutional law involving guns. It's just not applicable to me. And I said, guys, just let, you know,
And at one point, I know you've discussed the progression of your practice, because you have taken on these are Atticus Finch type cases. These are cases in which there is implicit bias, there's overt bias, there's prejudice, there's the too young. You know, there's the. I remember a lawyer that I think very highly of, trying to get jurors to relate to, without offending them, but trying to get them to relate to the fact that they have biases and prejudices against people who are of color. And I remember one of the lines that he had used in a voir dire was something like, "Oh, so you're not prejudiced at all?" No. When is the last time you read an Essence magazine? Have you ever read a Jet magazine? Do you know any of the lineup on BET? Have you ever dated a person of color? Do you have a daughter? And if your daughter came home with a man who was of color and said, "This is my fiance," you'd be okay with it? Now, the answers were always, you know, but the last one was the look of, he was looking to see the reaction of jurors at that visual image.
Right.
How do you handle that in your cases? Because you're taking on cases where you have to, the police are or the other side is portraying their client, the defendant, as the good guy, and your client as the bad guy, and they're playing into that prejudice. How do you handle that?
You know, kind of going back to the TED talk, you know, nobody raises their hand and admits to bias. You just can't. It's not a human trait. There's some people that
Larry David, oh, yeah.
But yeah, but you know, most people won't. And it's, I tell people, I'm not Republican. I'm not Democrat. I'm reasonable, you know, when asked that question. And I always get a laugh like, yeah, I see what you did there. Yeah, it's, you know, we're not reasonable. And that's, you know, that's kind of the approach. You know, we talked about it this morning that Republicans used to be known for, you know, constitutional conservatism or, you know, promoting the Bill of Rights and the Constitution more than anything. And, you know, now Republican leadership are again, in Florida, passing a law to allow arrests for loud music, you know how that's going to be regulated. And what they're trying to do implicitly is get more pullovers of African Americans.
You're not expecting people to get pulled over listening to the polka.
It's not going to happen.
Polka music.
It's so. Not going to happen. And so it's, you know, but in like tort reform, like now you can sue on abortion and you can sue on what children are being taught. I thought Republicans were for tort reform. And now it's just we've capitalized democracy and rewarded bad behavior in so many different ways that, you know, the approach to jurors always is changing too. Like Trump or not, I don't, you know, care what somebody's opinion is on Donald Trump, but Donald Trump proved that you can say or do anything pretty much as president of the United States. And that passes down to the average person. They are, between social media and what we've come through, they are more empowered than ever. And so, you know, the good news is you can do, can't really in federal court, but in state court, you can do full day jury selection and get people talking, you know, and bury themselves if need be. But it's hard work, and you're always trying to get into the psychosocial, you know, call and response of figuring out, all right, you know, what does this mean? And is this somebody that, you know, cause you know, and I know, and your audience is well educated in this, you know, it's not jury selection, it's jury deselection. And so let me get rid of, you know, these very few people that I can get rid of, you know, for hopefully for cause, but if not, you know, peremptory. But
what's
hard work.
It is hard work. And there are, do you like jury selection?
Some days it's my favorite. Some days cross-examination is my favorite, and some days closing is my favorite. But
is it just depend on the case or the moment or the jury or the trial?
It does. You know, the best, we had in that Greg Hill case, they had a gun expert from Canada, okay? Their gun expert literally was Canadian, which is completely different with handguns. Like it's night and day different. And this guy, and I probably should be careful what I say because we're going to trial next month, but this guy immediately he heard everything at direct, answered, but immediately couldn't hear me as soon as I stood up. Didn't matter how I did it. And so talking about theatrics, I'd keep moving. I move five different times in the courtroom. Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? Judge, can you hear me now? And the jury started kind of laughing at him because they realized what I was doing, what he was doing. And, you know, he was playing a game. And it got worse because, you know, question three, I'm like, you know, Mr. Blank, do you remember from your deposition where I asked you to give me the amount of money that you've billed St. Lucie County Sheriff's Office? Yeah. And you didn't have that then? No. Do you have it today? No. Well, my father just died. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know. Yes, you didn't know. I'm sorry. So that prevented you. And I hate to ask, but that prevented you. This is like I'm reading it because I've read it so many times for the appeal. You know, I did that prevent you? Yes. Well, it did because I just lost my father. How long ago? Weeks ago. All right. So I try to rehab that bombshell because now I'm grilling this guy who just lost his dad. Meanwhile, Mr. Blank is old. Like, he is gray and old. And so it doesn't matter. You still, losing your father is still a big deal. And so we get done with the trial, and I'm like, by the way, let's look up when Mr. Blank's father died. And it was like 3 months before trial. I'm like, this guy, like, he just kind of perjured himself over when his father died after not being able to hear me.
And used it as an excuse. Like,
he totally did.
I mean, talk about, I mean, that's not the dog ate my homework. That's like, I mean, that's 15 times worse.
It's awful. And one of my former associates, so I posted it. I'll free live on Facebook when there's stuff like that. And so as I'm writing the appeal, I'm like, just want to float this by you guys, because this happened. And I had a piece of the transcript, and one of my associates called my, she didn't go to me, she went to my office manager and said, you know, I think what John posted is inappropriate, because the guy lost his father. And I called her in. I was like, listen, if you want me to take something down, don't go to Teresa. Just message me. I'll take it down. But I was like, you know, this guy's 60 something years old and lost his father and wasn't in any way honest about when he did and used it to his advantage.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
I said, so I get where you wouldn't necessarily pick on that. But on the same token, I have gotten so much information by posting something on social media where somebody, you know, another lawyer that follows my page says, oh yeah, Mr. Blank, shoot, he did that to me.
Oh wow. It's you're using some of that as like a focus group or as a tribaloons and kind of floating stuff out there.
I focus group on social media like wildfire.
It's brilliant. Because you're getting feedback from people who are just, and you're getting a sense. We tried a case, a case in which a police officer died, and we were, the old saying, we fell in love with the lie. You know what I mean? And we with the line, and we had, like, you know, from the a golfing analogy, and when we started making our exhibits and getting ready for trial, we had just kind of moved past an elementary issue that when we presented the case to the person who was helping us make our exhibits and our demonstrative exhibits, the person paused and goes, wait, I'm bothered by this issue. And we're like, whoa. We've just moved past that because we've been preparing this case for a year. And once we decided to focus group that and talk about it, and man, that just really, really changed how we tried the case, because
right.
An issue that was important to her, who knew nothing about the case at all, was an issue that was going to be very important to the jurors, and it turned out that was true. Let me ask you a basic kind of war story question. I know you've no doubt been involved in some cross examinations where you get done and you have that few good men moment, you know, the Lieutenant Jessup moment or the Perry Mason moment. They don't happen all the time, despite what people may think, but they happen enough if you're a good lawyer, and I know you are. So share a couple that come to mind about cross examinations that where you think, man, that I wish I could do that every time I got up here.
Yeah, I had one last week. So was that last week or week before? But so RSD, right? I don't know if you've counted RSD, but I'll give it a short explanation. Reflex sympathetic disorder, dystrophy, depending upon who you're talking to. But it's a subset of chronic regional pain syndrome. It's rated on the pain scale as one of the most painful things you can get. Doctors don't understand it. It's sometimes akin to fibromyalgia, but it's different. It's where the sympathetic nervous system just starts firing nonstop. And so you could have, you know, just this small trauma and somebody develops RSD and they are dealing with allodynia, which is, you know, where a sheet could cause excruciating pain, right? And so I hate RSD cases because the pain my clients are in, but I love RSD cases because they are exquisite in damages. And they're controversial, and if you know it, you can win them. And so, you know, we're teeing up for trial of a RSD case. Client had a table fall on her. She sent me videos that are telltale signs of RSD. You know, but in order to diagnose RSD under the Budapest, you know, series of factors, you need a couple of things. You need a temperature difference between limbs. So the right and left leg, for instance, have a degree or two temperature difference. The human skin can only detect about a degree or so. So, you know, you got to drill down with thermometers, not literally. Skin changes. So, you know, one might be red. Hair follicles and stuff might be a little different. You know, a few more things. So I've got this RSD expert. I had never dealt with him before. Great doctor out of the Carolinas. And I message all the listservs like, hey, what do you guys know? Do you have a deposition? And they're like, oh, he's a straight shooter. He's a great doctor. I've hired him. I'm like, I don't know. Because he didn't just say my client. He didn't say my client was faking RSD, because he had some temperature changes and some atrophy, and like he documented some, but he didn't go out on that limb, but he just said that she doesn't have it, which means she's faking it in a way, and so he's out on a limb, because in his report he notes temperature changes, and he notes size differential by tape measure. Okay, so we're into the deposition, and I come right through the front door. Hi, how are you, doctor? I've taken a lot of depositions about RSD. Mostly, I want to hear what you're going to tell the jury. I don't need you. I want to know what your canned answer is, frankly. Okay, let's get there. What's your definition of pain? Blah, 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 blah. How would you say it to a jury? Blah, 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 blah. Okay. So we do this for an hour, and then we get into his report. And in his report, he says that he noted temperature changes. And so I make him go get his notes to show me the temperature changes. Well, the guy took them in centigrade. And I'm like, doctor, why centigrade? Why Celsius? You know, why not Fahrenheit? He goes, well, that's the thermometer I had was set to centigrade or Celsius. I'm like, that's the only setting you use. Yeah, that's the only setting I use. So guess what? In a temperature change, centigrade, because it's lower number set, is going to show a smaller change than Fahrenheit. And so during the break, I'm like converting the damn numbers that I just got into Fahrenheit. And I'm like, shit, these things are 3 or 4 degrees apart. Like, this is significant. A 4 degree difference between one leg to the other that he's documented that may only look like 1 degree centigrade. I'm like, this is a big deal. And so I sandbag it to the end. And then he also did a tape measure around the calf, I think. And in one measurement, he notes a half inch or inch. I'm surprised he didn't use centimeters. But half inch to inch, that would have been more, difference. But said when he was measuring the other, the client, my client, he was a CME doc, told him to squeeze the leg a little further down. He notes that in his report. And so she wanted him to squeeze down, thus the half-inch differential, or whatever the differential was. I'm like, I get to the end, and I've been nice. Like, we are, there's not an objection. We are having, just like this, we're having an interview. I've gotten everything I need. And I'm like, all right, doc, I think I'm about done, but I got a few more questions. And then just nail it. And so I'm like, doc, you know, size differential, right? Yeah. But you say that the size differential is explained by her almost subjectively making you do the test different from one leg to the other. Yeah, that's what I say. So which is it, doctor? Did you fraudulently put down a number in your report, or did you provide an inaccurate measurement? Because you have an obligation to do this accurately, right? And he's like, well, that's not what I meant. I'm like, no. You blame her for the size differential, which means you went along with her, or you set her up so that you'd look good. So you'd come to this conclusion that the size differential doesn't exist. He's like, well, that's not what I meant. And so then I get into the centigrade Fahrenheit thing, and he's like, da, 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 da. And again, this is the straight shooter, right? And we pull, after the deposition, we pull the video, because we video CMEs, we pull the video, and dang it, if, you know, his thermometer on the website isn't set to Fahrenheit. Wow. And so it's
something like, you did there subtly, which was you had a point that you knew you'd be able to nail him on, which was the point about using centigrade or Celsius versus Fahrenheit, and you were doing the math. And so the point before that, you knew you're going to be able to nail him on that.
Right.
And the point before that is one that you wanted to challenge him on. And so he gives you whatever answer he gives you, and then you know that whatever answer he gives you, you can combat him a bit. But his credibility on that answer is going to be completely undercut with the point you're about to make, the follow-up point about using Celsius or centigrade. That's really smart.
He's done. And you smart. Have three things. The only other thing...
You're just propping up his chin, and then you're gonna hit him.
The only other thing is trophic changes, skin changes. And I was like, doctor, you saw that. So you didn't see it that day. No, I didn't see it that day. But you saw reports of other doctors, three, who diagnosed her with RSD, who saw it that day. He's like, well, it's not like that. It would be there all the time. I'm like, all right, so I think we're done here. You know, like I think you've gone on this limb and sawed it off, mainly because you either just fraudulently went along with my client saying, no, squeeze that one so it shows something different. Okay, I'll do it. But I'm going to blame her, or you just inaccurately measured, and then you're running around playing numbers games with centigrade and Fahrenheit on a thermometer that you're going to look like a moron when admitting that the standard is Fahrenheit. And, you know, now this guy that everybody says is a straight shooter might be fraudulent, you know?
It's a great cross.
Why? Like, why not just give her RSD and say it's not that bad?
But you did your homework, and you, as you got in there, you were listening, and it didn't make sense. And so that's part of what you have to do in order to be a trial lawyer, a good trial lawyer, as you are, a great trial lawyer. So you have to be able to listen, and if something doesn't sound right, you got to be able to react to it and think, okay, it didn't sound right. Something's not going. The bells are going off here. You got to be able to deal with it.
And you got to get off script. I mean, that's the thing I tell young lawyers all the time. Like, I can give you scripts, but if you're staying on script, if you planned it out, and you're not following every single answer down that answer's trail when it's important, then you're not getting the information you need. Why conduct a discovery deposition? Because, you know, this was discovery, although we've got a forced arbitration that's non-binding. I don't know why they don't call it mediation, but I guess because there's potential for witnesses.
Sounds better. Sounds more official if you say arbitration.
Yeah, but maybe the defense lawyers get paid more. But it's you know, that deposition that morning, I was like, man, we might just cancel this. I don't know that I'm going to get anything, because the numbers in the report show temperature change, you know, a degree. And in my brain, I'm used to seeing both C and F, but I hadn't really, you know, given it thought mid deposition. I'm like, wait a minute, let me literally get a calculator and extrapolate how much, holy crap, that's a lot of difference. And it makes them look like they're hiding something. And in personal injury, all you need is one of those. And, you know, when you got a feather's weight that tilts it, you know, you get one good witness that's a good cross-examination. You know, I had the Canadian gun expert looking like a fool by the end. But at some point, I think the jury sympathized with him. You know, like you can beat up on them too much. And, you know, then you've lost all the points you've made because you're too aggressive. And so it's finding that balance.
Well,
but it's such a beautiful dance.
So let me ask you this, because I know I've taken up. I so appreciate you talking to us. And I know that everybody probably wants to talk to you about Joe Exotic and the Tiger King. What drew you to that case? What made you, what kind of person is he? What's the, so.
There's Joe. So people send me Joe Exotic everything. So
what kind of
crazily
person
enough, what's that?
What kind of person?
He's a great person. You know, my kids really do call him Uncle Joe. So mostly I talk to him in the office on legal calls that are non-recorded. Occasionally, and used to a lot. Like there was a point when he was in Oklahoma that he and I spoke multiple times a day. But he's called 20 or 30 times when I've been at home, and my kids haven't seen Tiger King, but they certainly have seen the commercials and, you know, how it's infiltrated pop culture. And so they really do call him Uncle Joe. My oldest, you know, is in a fishing scene with me in Tiger King too. So he actually, I think, might be the only kid, because there's not many, you know, in the Tiger King series. There might be like two. And so, but he's seen that scene, but not, you know, the show. But Joe, and he wrote a book, and he talks about it in his book. But Joe's a collector, right? And with any collectors, with any person that has a passion, you can go too far, right? Moderation is the key. And so Joe collected too damn many. And admits it and owns it. And when Carol Baskin, you know, wound up picking on him about too damn many, he was unable to feed too damn many because his revenue sources from the mall trips and all that decreased. And so then he's begged, borrowing, and steal to continue to feed his many. And Joe is a good guy, a passionate guy. I like the guy. He really does care. He really was set up. You know, I our motions for new trial probably combined are hundreds of pages, including exhibits. And it tells the backstory, you know, the ending of Tiger King 2, where it's revealed that the hitman and Jeff Lowe were discussing killing Joe Exotic by the very same method that Joe Exotic allegedly planned Carol Baskin's death. That ain't coincidence. That's a trend. And it's one of the biggest pieces of evidence that, you know, the hitman's like, nah, man, I just took the $3,000 to get out of town. And Joe's like, I was just giving him $3,000 to get out of town. And they just, nobody knew what Tiger King was when all that trial happened. And so, unfortunately, there were some government officials that greased the wheels with lightning grease. And, you know, Joe's imperfect. We all are. But I really, truly believe he gets out. You know, the average length of a post-conviction relief case is, what, 6, 7, 8 years. And so I've only been on it a year and a half.
I've listened to, you're passionate about your belief as to when you believe he'll get out. I've listened to you. You have things called Tiger Tales. I know they're on your, you've got a significant page on your website that deals with your representation of Joe Exotic, right, it seems, from the moment that you were walking into the prison to go talk to him and then walking out and made a statement that you were taking on his case. So, John, I have one question I ask everybody.
Yep.
If you could cross-examine any one person, dead or alive, who would it be?
You're going to have to edit out some dead time while I'm thinking.
I've heard from some Donald Trump. I heard someone else said, somebody said,
Abraham. So I was close to getting Donald Trump and I really, really wanted it. And that's the name that came to mind because he got away from me.
Someone
you know,
said
we settled.
OJ,
yeah. It, who, because I want this answer you haven't heard before that's also the right answer for me. You know, so let me say this. My favorite case is where I have a evil, dirty bastard on the other side. Howard Schneider abused 100 kids, was yanking out teeth. Love that case because I had somebody nobody'd like. So Hitler, right? You'd have to want to get into his head in cross-examination. So I'm going Adolf Hitler because there's no more evil person who has escaped justice in world history than that. Has that been said before?
No.
Okay.
No, the only thing we ever, no one's ever said Hitler, and I love the way you phrased it. No novelty of it, but because no one has ever sat down and said, we've had the Nuremberg trial, but that involved others, and it would be like, look.
Correct.
So I would love the idea of watching some people in history, even people in recent history, be held accountable. I'm not talking about where they get 5 minutes of questioning by a senator or representative who talks the whole time.
Right.
I'm talking about where someone is with a judge sitting there, with a jury looking on, with their life hanging in the balance, and a guy like you who's, you know, knows the material and is able to control them and get the answers and, you know, and I think I would love to see some of the people in Washington have the same, you know, don't give me the talking points.
We were close. I mean, we were really close on Trump. And the arbitrator, because we were in arbitration, so, you know, but he gave me some campaign officials and there was another embarrassment that was so amazing. And that one was videotaped. Where their expert came on and said that the only remedy was for Omarosa to pay back $800,000 because they had to do anti-race, anti-women, or pro-women, pro-race commercials because of these minuscule things Omarosa said at the exclusion of everything else. It was just Omarosa. And so Omarosa needed to pay $800,000. And we're like, what about campaign finance laws? And he's like, oh, shit. And then, you know, we nailed him because the night before, again, preparation. Night before, I'm on my little, you know, my little device looking up this expert. And damn it, if he didn't defame the hell out of Donald Trump at every turn on Twitter. And it was years before. And I'm like, so didn't you contribute to this, reputation of Donald as ignorant or anti-black or anti-women? Well, no, not at all. Well, you're an expert. Like, you're the expert. And so it was another, I'm done with this guy, you know? And, but we were so close to getting Donald, and I'm fine with how it ended because I got a nice attorney's fee on it. But dang it, you know, you do this work that kind of matters, and you want the law reversed, or you want that deposition, you want that thing, because I have some money, you know, I got a nice pen, you know, I got that stuff. There'll be other cases, but you don't get that change. And that's what makes it fun. And that's like Greg Hill, like the family doesn't care what the verdict is. They do, but it's holding a sheriff's office responsible. That's the thing, especially in Florida, you know, all these civil rights cases, George Floyd, all of it. You don't see the civil trial very often. They settle it or they go away. And it's,
well, you seem like the kind of guy that's willing to take it all the way. And I respect
so that. So that question, this is where I'll end. Even though you tried to end it, you know, 5 minutes ago, that question you asked me about cross-examination, I was asked, about trial of a case. And it was straight up, what case, Supreme Court level, trial level, whatever, would you retry? What case would you just want more than anything else to try? And I said, give me my $4 verdict case back. It's all that matters. Just give me that case back and let me have a snap at that one again. And that was before it was reversed.
And I want to tell you something. It's not that I've tried to end the interview. It's that I am respectful of your time. I could talk to you all day, on or off, but I am respectful of the time that you give to me and to the podcast to talk about these issues, and to kind of kick the tire, so to speak, and hear how you approach things. And I love that answer you just gave. You want to keep talking, I'll talk to you for as long as you want, but you know, you probably got work to do, and I do as well, but I love that answer. That is probably my favorite answer I've heard on this podcast, which is, who do you want to cross-examine? Who do you want? What case? Forget about all that. I want that case that eluded me. I want that verdict that eluded me, that was in a way sort of a slap in the face, and I want that one. And it sounds like you're going to get that chance. So
we are going to get the chance. A lot of pressure there, though, you know? So mid-July, we got another date. We got a new judge, and we're going to try to
circle back. I hope I at least can chat with you or get an update on that case at some point. Cause that
please.
Is the idea that you could be shot in your own garage, in your own house, the garage closed, with a gun perfectly compartmentalized and compacted in your back pocket, where it would be impossible, given the nature of the shots, for the gun to have been out and then for it to have been, you know, neatly and acutely put back into your back pocket, where you ultimately your heart stopped beating and you lost your life. I mean, look, we expect to be protected in our home. We expect to be safe in our home. And the idea that these sorts of things, a loud noise, like you talked about with Jordan Davis, music, that music coming from a garage, that these things could be handled with a uh, uh, a phone call. They can be handled with a note. They can be handled with a loud noise violation ticket. We send it in the mail. What happens is, as you know and you see in your practice all too often, these minor infractions, these I won't even call them infractions, these minor events, they lead to just to death and destruction and invasion of privacy, and people suffer. And I do give you a lot of credit, John. That was a phenomenal answer, but the answer moved me. And it tells me why you have done so well in your practice and why you're such a sought after lawyer.
Thank you, brother.
And tell just so people can find you, it's www.floridajustice.com. Is that right?
Floridajustice.com is the website. Twitter is at John Phillips. Instagram is at John Phillips ESQ. You know, thanks to Tiger King, I've gotten verified on all of them.
Let me tell you something, folks. You are talking to a real lawyer. Now, I mean that. We haven't had people on here that aren't, but I want you to understand that most of the people that I talk to are criminal defense lawyers. You are the real deal, man. And I'm not just saying that. I am. I'm so appreciative of you and Catherine for making time to fit the podcast into your schedule. But you're the real deal, and I hope I want people to find your TED Talk. It is out there. It is a fantastic TED Talk, and it is an uncomfortable. It's a different environment. You can't promote yourself when you're up there, but you want to see a guy talking about his history and his past and how he got to this point. You find the John Phillips TED Talk, and I think it was entitled. It was the unevolving virus in America. I think it was prejudice, the unevolving virus in America.
It's something like that, yeah. And it's like you can taste the cotton mouth during that thing. Like the viewer rides, you know, kind of the roller coaster of. Look, there's
John. It's as good as I've given a TED Talk, and yours was as good a TED Talk as I've seen. And I've seen them from. It was good. I'm telling you, it was good because I could hear it in your voice. I could hear it in your voice. I'm telling you, it was a great TED Talk. I related to it because this is what I do for a living, and I've chosen to do this for a living, But I watched it, and it was great. And I'm not just – if it wasn't great, I wouldn't have talked to you about it. I just wouldn't have even – I wouldn't have broached it. But it's worth watching. When you go out and people want to hire or find a lawyer to represent them, you got to find someone that's passionate about this. You got to find someone that's willing to actually to step out there. And you got to find someone that you can relate to. And John, I have a lot of respect for you. And
thank you, brother.
I'm not saying that because we're like buddies or anything. I'm telling you that because it's true. John Phillips, thank you for giving me your time and us your time on the Killer Cross Examination podcast. And I am going to follow up with you on that case. And it's an important case. And I wish you and the family the best.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you, man. Thank you.
Bye-bye.